From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. was a tragedy, of course. But the fight for civil rights did not end in Memphis in 1968. The crusade has taken many forms since King's murder, and one recent iteration is the movement known as Black Lives Matter. A new documentary series from PBS explores the history of activism in the struggle for racial equality. It's called Black America Since MLK. The series is narrated by Harvard historian Henry Louis Gates Jr., and it premieres on GPB later this month. Some have already had the chance to see it in Georgia. GPB offered a screening of the documentary last month, along with a panel discussion that I moderated. We had three guests. Mary Hooks is a leader in Atlanta's Black Lives Matter movement. Maurice Hobson is a professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. And David Wall Rice teaches psychology at Morehouse College. Today, we'll hear portions of that discussion. And we'll start at the moment when I asked David Wall Rice if the Black Panther movement was actually in conflict with Martin Luther King's nonviolent campaign. Just a warning, this discussion features the use of a term that might be offensive to some, so listen with caution.
I think that oftentimes what happens with the Black Power movement and the civil rights movement properly is that they're placed at opposite ends of a spectrum, erroneously so. And so we certainly know that the Black Power movement would not have been able to exist without the civil rights movement. But to think of the two as being in conflict with one another, I think is a mistake. We certainly see that there are multiple solutions and approaches to problems of white supremacy. And certainly a nonviolent response is one that is morally centered and astute. But when you're talking about violence, we all know that Malcolm X said to defend yourself when you're being persecuted. Is that a question of violence or a question of self-defense? And so I think that a lot of times when you look at the optics of the Black Panther Party, the Black Power movement, certainly you see leather coats, shotguns, berets, and things like that. But if you look at the essence of what it is that these groups were doing, they were hosting free breakfast and lunch programs. They were shuttling people throughout the community. And so I think that it becomes really, really important for us as people who are connected to this rich and powerful past of protest and activism to really understand and know what it is that these movements are a part of. Because the movement is the same in that we're looking for liberation, justice, and freedom.
But let's bring this forward then, because we have this same conflict today. And while we may think that this is a construct placed upon African Americans, this was also a choice that many African Americans felt they had to make and challenged other people to make. So then you come to the modern Black Lives Matter movement, and you have lions of the civil rights movement calling the protesters unlovable brats and saying, if you want to make progress, you have to do it with decorum and dignity. So how are we to interpret the end of the civil rights movement? Did we end it in a way that could be carried forward?
I think what we're seeing, though, is that there is a huge tension when you see a newer iteration of movement that comes up, and oftentimes, and should be, with a more radical left sort of politic and demand, and what we're asking for and demanding in this country. And I think it is a little bit of like, yo, okay, you all are like really trying to step out here, and folks are like, don't know what their role is in this time. Mm-hmm. In terms of other structured long-term organizations, there's a particular role that we must be playing in how we are in formation with each other. And so I think the conflict is just comes because, you know, you still have like elder civil rights folks who are in the room negotiating the terms of this current fight, right? When those who are on the front lines, those who are in Ferguson, those who have been doing this work are like, yo, we actually have some demands that, you know, we're trying to move forward and we need y'all's support, transfer of relationships, a variety of things need to happen. And so I don't think it's necessarily conflict. We're part of the legacy, particularly in the South, of the civil rights movement. And the Black Power movement did manifest in the South in a lot of ways, but we saw that primarily on the West and East Coast. So those of us who do work in the South and are rooted in the South, are building on that legacy and are clear about what it has meant to create the opportunity and to work in coalition alliance in order to be able to come into formation with each other.
Okay, to quote Beyonce, right? So Let's move on to another part of that very first segment. And they were talking about the rise of African-American culture. But one of the things that's been said often was that the early hopes when they saw people like Aretha Franklin, Motown Rose, when they saw African-Americans on TV and in movies, the hope was that the leadership and the rise of African-American culture would lead to a rise in African-Americans in business and respect in politics. And many people say that has not happened. So Maurice, where was perhaps the disconnect, if you buy that?
I don't buy it. And I'll say this to contribute to the first question and then segue into the second question. As a historian, when you begin to learn the conversation around civil rights and black power, we often get this misrepresented idea of civil rights as being from 1954, Brown v. Board of Education, to 1965, the Voting Rights Act coming out of Selma, or 1968 with the assassination of Dr. King. The truth of the matter is that there's always been an issue of civil and human rights, particularly that pertain to African Americans in this country. And so there is a new kind of conversation called the Long Movement. Now, in terms of the rise of African American culture, one of the things that comes about with this is that when you have the codification or the ways in which black power come about, it has an expressive culture that is matched with it called black art. And so there were a lot of different things that were coming out of black power, particularly Amiri Baraka and the Conference for African People. You had numerous things that took place, but you also see a youth culture on the ground that is really grounded and looking at icons such as Aretha Franklin, Muhammad Ali. The conversation with this is, I don't buy it, because whenever there's a political movement, then there is an expressive cultural movement that is joined with it.
The next segment that we saw was largely focused on OJ, and that feeds yes. into the topic of culture and celebrity. And there has been a question about whether there seems to be a divide among American treatment in the way that we treat African-American celebrities one way and the way that we treat African-Americans in general. What do you make of that?
I mean, I just think it's the case. So when we're talking about celebrity and when we're talking about the performance of blackness within the spaces, the limited arrested developmental spaces that white folks can understand and appreciate. And so when we're talking about this idea of, well, how is it that we can appreciate Oprah, we can appreciate Bill Cosby, or at least we did, we can appreciate, O.J. Simpson. Well, those folks in many instances have painted themselves and expressed themselves as being colorless. And that's not to say and to remove their blackness from them and their penetration into the black community. But the way that we understand and we appreciate them is because they are visible to white folks because they service them in a particular way. And so it becomes easy to understand and to appreciate that serviceability within kind of these hegemonic norms of what it is that blackness is supposed to look like in terms of Oprah being a 21st century mammy. Right? And that sounds harsh in many instances, but a large woman who's able to really coddle through the experience of her talk show, having a guy who is Bill Cosby, who's on The Cosby Show, who we dig and oftentimes co-signs these politics of respectability. But when he comes out and talks about black folks in very, very scathing ways at the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, the NAACP, I think you look to kind of this artistic power when you ask somebody like August Wilson, well, what do you think of what it is that Bill Cosby said about black folks? He says, well, what do you expect from a clown? That sounds harsh, but really that is the space that Bill Cosby has occupied. When you're talking about how it is that we treat and understand celebrity and culture, O.J. Simpson was great because we understood, and that documentary on him on ESPN is such a great sociological, psychological treatise. It really, I invite folks to look at that, because what he has done is he has painted himself and convinced himself that he is no color. I'm not black, I'm not white, I'm O.J. Well, I mean, great, that's what we want. We want you to sell our product. We want you to bang the hell out your head playing football every single week, and we'll give you a white woman if you know how to treat her right.
Mary. I'm going to leave that there. So there were a number of people, though, who defended Bill Cosby previous to the recent revelations. Mm-hmm. by saying that what he said wasn't that far away from what was said at the Million Man March. And there have been questions about why the Million Man March didn't become a new civil rights movement. What happened to the energy that led to that? And so what Dr. Skip Gates brings up in this, I think, is an interesting point. This dichotomy of people saying, look at how bad institutionalized racism is, and yet where is our personal responsibility? What is that little marker on the footnote, on the pathway of civil rights mean to you?
I think if anything, black folks, we always have the challenge and responsibility to juggle all three layers in which oppression shows up, right? Internally, interpersonally, and institutionally, right? Talk about systemic oppression. And we talk about the interpersonal, where individuals and people are beefing with each other. And then you have, you know, the lies that you believe that this white supremacist world has taught us, right? And how we internalize that. And so there is no, I think, what the intent was, absence of having another layer of strategy in terms of how do we build power together and actually identifying and connecting what was actually happening beyond you did blaming it on us. I grew up, most of my family impacted by the war on drugs and the crack epidemic, watching this play out in my community. And so unless we are willing to own what that did to our people, to have a conversation like that, absence of talking about what the mass incarceration has done to our people, and that there is actually people in power that is responsible for this, and it is no accident, that's where we miss it. Because then people go back into their individual silos and say, okay, I'm gonna try to find that job. However, the system keeps working. The system keeps taking money out of folks' check. And so absence of having an understanding of, yes, we have to deal with our interpersonal stuff. White supremacy has an impact on everybody, even white people, I'd say the most, mm-hmm. right? And so spiritually what that does and what has done to our people, you know? And so we have to grapple with that, and we have to grapple with how we engage with each other and other people in this world. Of course, we're human. But the systemic stuff, and if we can use those relationships together to actually combat power, to actually confront the people who are responsible for the conditions of our lives, like, that's a different conversation in terms of what that could have looked like. The tone of it was so seeped in patriarchy, you know what I mean? Was so seeped in patriarchy, painting black men as if you get right, our families will be better. And that's a heavy load to bear, because absence of saying, but bruh, you still got your race that you grapple with every day. Your maleness, your manhood is not gonna save you from this. You know what I mean? And so what does it look like to interrogate patriarchy and misogyny in that space? How far we would have gone? You know what I mean? Like at that moment, could you imagine what the cultural shift would have been if we declared in that moment that black men would stop talking, being homophobic, would stop disrespecting black women, and like called for that in a major way and ran a campaign about it. Now that we know better, we do better. We're all growing in our consciousness around how we see our movement and how we see each other in relationship to each other. That's why I can sit up here as a black lesbian queer mama, and y'all are like, yes, it's good, because we grow from that.
I want to bring us forward to where this series actually ends when you see it in its entirety, which is with Barack Obama. And there was, at the beginning of his presidency, so much talk about post-racial society, which is almost ludicrous at today. We are talking about race more than ever. We're talking about the violence. It's gotten to the point, I don't even click on those videos anymore. I can't spiritually take it. So there is a faction in the country that feels that's Obama's fault. There's a faction in the country that feels that it is 100% white America's fault. So let me begin with you, Maurice, and say, why are we here a half a century since Martin Luther King Jr.'s death? Why does it feel as though race is more tense, racial relations are more tense, and we are farther apart than ever before?
Well, again, when you study social movements, this is how I always come to understand what they are. If you want to see the rise of white supremacy, you always need to see what progress black people have made as a result. So when the Klan was founded in 1866, that was a result of the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and then the subsequent 15th Amendment. And so you see this rise. After Reconstruction and the states' rights movement, you see the rise of the Klan because you see black folk voting with their feet, leaving the American South and going other places. After World War II, when African Americans fought insatiably for this nation in war and would come back to the United States, black men would be lynched in their uniforms to reestablish the power order. And what happens with this is when the movie The Klansman was created by D.W. Griffin and it later becomes Birth of a Nation, the original Birth of a Nation. It was used as a recruiting tool for the Klan. You see major Klan movement that takes place in the 1930s. You see it in the 1960s. And the most recent is in 2008 after the election of Barack Obama. And so what I'm saying here is oftentimes white supremacy and all of his arrogance is oftentimes a result of some kind of political gain by a marginalized community. We have an election that will take place soon. And if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected as president, you can also expect to see a level of recalcitrance that will take place as a result of that. So what I attribute is that someone that hasn't been a part of the Herring Vote, the white hegemonic order, now has been able to be seated in a place of power, and you see recalcitrance as a result.
Your response, Obama's fault?
Oh yeah, it's his fault.
Everything is his fault.
Yeah, it's his fault. But really to riff off of kind of the genius analysis from right there is it's his fault because he's a black man, and he's a black man with a black family. So psychologically and sociologically, think about what that does to folks who are embedded in this white supremacist space. You see this every single day. I mean, it's not just him leading the country. Damn it, maybe that would be enough. But looking at him with his two dogs walking across the White House lawn with two beautiful girls and his wife, a basketball court. He's doing all kinds of black stuff, probably eating chicken and watermelon, Kool-Aid and everything. But I think that the thing is that it's his fault in as much as he's making America look at itself. So when folks are here right now, you know, like, I can't believe, oh my gosh, Trump is, this is just unimaginable and I can't, I mean, what are you talking about? You know, I'm really confused as to how it is that you are surprised that this could take place, right? This is what white supremacy looked like when I went to Key Elementary School, coming from central Los Angeles, going to Arlington, Texas on the first day of school. Stephen Couples said, "What's up, nigga?" And I'm like, God, dog, this is really different than where I came from, right? That's what that looks like. Stephen Couples is getting ready to go into the White House. Now, I cracked Stephen Couples on the back of his neck in the seventh grade with a beaker bottle and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of that black power stuff and the civil rights. But I went to Morehouse to make up for it and all that kind of stuff. But I think that it becomes important for us to look at, when we're looking at fault and blame, we really have to look at these systems of white supremacy, these systems of racism, and they're built to do what it is that they're supposed to do, but we have the responsibility to call it out and to make it accountable, right? And so if we're in these spaces, oftentimes we're in rarefied spaces. We're in the Georgia Public Broadcasting Building. This is a beautiful space, and we're talking, you know, very, you know, theoretically and astutely about what's going on. What are we gonna do? What's the work? What are we doing? You know what I'm saying? And so it's absolutely Obama's fault in as much as it is your fault as being a black person existing in your skin and thinking that your life matters.
Well, that takes us straight to Mary, because you're part of the Black Lives Matter movement. How dare you? Where do you stand on this issue? Whose fault is it?
I think it's obviously it's the systems. The fault feels so, it feels so, it doesn't feel strong enough. Like, it doesn't feel like a strong enough word, because we're like, I don't know, it feels weird to say, like, who's at fault? It feels petty. This isn't petty, you know what I mean? And so that's the part I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can say fault, but I know who's guilty. I know who's guilty, you know what I mean? And I know who shouldn't be able to sleep at night because of the way our people are suffering, and it's not our folks. And so I think one of the things that you were saying about what then do we do and that we must act, right? But I do think that in terms of what is being done, there is a movement for Black lives that is happening. And I name it as like this iteration of the Black liberation struggle, right? This isn't nothing new. I know a lot of folks got involved with movement August 9th, 2014, but movement has been happening again since our people got off of the boat.
That's right.
Like,
that's
part of that, that's us. And not because, for no other reason, it's because we have a mandate to do so. Mm-hmm. Black people have a mandate in this time, mm-hmm. and we have to earn the respect of our of future generations, and we have to avenge the suffering of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And it also causes us to be transformed in the service of the work. And when I say that, this movement requires, in terms of where we should be going, and how, and not just what we should be doing, but how we should be doing it, the tone in which, and the spirit in which we show up to do this work, coming from a spiritual place of this is what we have to be doing, right? And so some of that work looks like, in real time, early August, the Movement for Black Lives, which is a cosmos of organizations, several, there's many, Black Youth Project 100, Southerners on New Ground, Black Lives Matter, it's the network, Million Hoodies, the Organization for Black Struggle, Ferguson, I mean, the list goes on. And I always get a little, because when we say the Black Lives Matter movement, we try to have some nuance around that so people don't think it's one organization that's mm-hmm. turning up. Mm-hmm. There's several formations, and there's several older organizations that are also in support of that and have found their role. So I don't want to be, you know, saying that that's not always the case, right? But there's a policy table that just dropped out, a policy platform that's talking about what does it look like to be saying we want our government monies to be divesting from police and investing in our lives and those and heal what you have done. Right. Take ownership, clean this mess up. We can't do this, but if you give us the resources that we rightfully deserve as reparation for what you've done to us, we can fix and heal ourselves.
So this is the moment when we can take questions. We have people ready to bring a microphone to you. So if you have a question, raise your hand.
My question is, how much of a role has assimilation played since integration? Because I'm a product of integration. I grew up here in Atlanta. I remember Auburn Avenue, and I remember the ownership of Black businesses. And I also recall my family members discussing how Black businesses were burned out, moved out, eliminated from back in the pre-integration movement. So how much role of assimilation since integration has played in the complacency of thinking that we are post-racial as opposed to the reality that we actually exist in?
Maurice, you want to handle that?
Sure. So I have the distinct pleasure and curse of studying Atlanta. I study the city of Atlanta nationally, internationally, and so I have a lot of conversations around Sweet Auburn. But this is the thing. There's a concept after 1961 here in Atlanta called the Black Brain Drain. And so when schools integrated, before schools integrated, your Black institutions, schools, institutions of higher learning, and whatever, whatnot, became diluted. Your clientele in terms of businesses, particularly on the Auburn Avenue corridor, became diluted because it removed these businesses from their actual clientele. And so what happens with this is I do tours of the Sweet Auburn district. I do them often. And I take my students down through Sweet Auburn and I say there's more African-American history within a mile of Georgia State University than any university in the world. We walk down Sweet Auburn and I tell about the greatness of Sweet Auburn, and then they're like, well, what happened? And so the thing about this is one of the conversations around the Black New South, once Black people were able to establish themselves within Black political empowerment and electoral politics, and there's this idea that the veil of segregation was removed from them, we begin to see Black political empowerment mature. And when it matures, it fractures. And so we begin to understand the difference between the Black elite, the Black middle class, the Black working class, the Black working poor, mm-hmm. the Black poor, and what we call the underclass. Mm-hmm. You begin to understand that there are numerous Black communities that vote or think in terms of politics in their own understanding. And so what we have seen is the maturation of Black communities and the Black vote. And we see that across the board. I mean, Black LGBTQ, first-generation African-born Black folk. You see all of these different components that are really ripe for a city such as Atlanta.
Another question.
Yes, good evening. My question is seemingly kind of odd, but the question is, what is white supremacy? And I'm asking this question because I'm 40, my late 40s, and I learned about what this was from my growing up, from my cultural exposure through hip hop and just college and my parents. And there was a certain way that I learned to understand this term and this phenomenon with some context. I've heard white supremacy mentioned more than any time in history over the last 8 years, pretty much since the president has been in office. And that term has been mentioned a lot here. What, in simple terms, is white supremacy?
Okay, well, let me give that to Mary because I think she used that term a lot.
I do, huh? I do, because it's real, yo. I would say I'm gonna try to simplify it. I would say that white supremacy is not just the ideal that white people are superior and more superior than black and other people of color, but I think it's about the use of that power to oppress those people through the policies, laws, systems that they create to build systems and institutions that keep us suffering from their profits, right? I think it also, one of the ways in which I like to also understand white supremacy, if you ever watch like the Game of Thrones, or you watch Rain, or all of those movies that are set in like Europe, and they're talking about, you know, to me that is the freshest form of white supremacy. The ideal that we create an empire and our lineage of whiteness is so fantastic that we must own, dominate, and take by any means necessary in order to secure that for our people at the expense of others, and primarily black people and melanated people. And so that colonizer mindset and white supremacy shows up in the way that it enters other countries, the way that it, hell, and gentrification. I told my, and I have to just be honest with you, I questioned my white neighbor the other day. And I said, friend, I must ask you, as a white person, what brings you into this neighborhood? You know, like, I know you've heard of gentrification. Everybody's talking about it. And she said, well, I'm from a middle-class white family in the suburbs, and I worked in the foster care system, and the culture is so different here. Like, people sit on porches, and, you know, it's just really cool. And I just wanted to live and be a part of that. And I said, that's interesting. I said, because that's the same sort of mentality that this country uses when they take over other continents and countries. Same mentality.
Manifest destiny.
Manifest destiny. Same thing. And so I asked her, I said, do you understand the impacts of what it looks like when white people move like colonizers into black communities and the impacts of that and what it means for all of the black wealth that was, you know, that was lost in these communities for you to be, you know, benefiting off of that suffering? Are people losing so much? But anyway, but watch Game of Thrones. and its purest form, patriarchy. I always say patriarchy is the oldest form of oppression, the way men have always tried to dominate women, and you see that in its purest form. But now we have to look at white supremacy and how it uses capitalism, how it uses patriarchy, how it uses racism in order to advance the agenda of white supremacy and white power over everything else.
So I'll give you my first Blanche response, and I hope it doesn't sound callous. I don't think a lot about what white folks are afraid of. It's largely because I think that becomes part and parcel of the question that was just asked around white supremacy, is this idea around privilege. It has a lot to do with how it is that white folks have become allies in kind of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? And this idea around, well, all lives matter, and, well, I'm out here with my Black Lives Matter t-shirt and all that kind of stuff. That's real good, but fall back. Because this is not your, you know, it's your struggle to be aligned with, but it's not one for you to be a central figure in, unless you are assuming responsibility and the type of accountability that we kind of talked about, I think, across the panelists here. I'm not done. So that was my first response. So that was my first like guttural response. And then, like, my more, you know, Wade and humanist response is one that is, that I think about Friday, don't be scared, Craig. because I'm thinking, why are you afraid? You know, I think that that begs an examination of what your whiteness means to you and the trappings of what that whiteness means, and that becomes important for you to look at. And I really appreciated this allusion to Toni Morrison and to Baldwin when they talk about this idea of what racism means to the white person. It's more deleterious, Toni Morrison says, to the white person than it is to the target, because you are the ones who are visiting this evil onto people. So what do you need to do? When you're calling me, Baldwin says, when you're calling me Stephen Couples, when you're calling me nigger, that doesn't say anything about me. It says something about what you need me to be. So you need to examine that. So that fear then, thank you, that was Baldwin. but that fear then becomes something that is important, I think, for you to bring up and to be very honest about. And it becomes important for you to examine it. What does that mean in terms of me being a human and understanding the respect and respectability that I need to afford to all other humans who don't enjoy the privileges that I have?
Thank you. My question is, you spoke about various organizations, maybe even some of the more historical organizations such as the NAACP, the SCLC, we've got Black Lives Matter, we've got so many organizations. Do you ever see or hear, or is there a rumbling of the merging of all the various groups coming together, if not as one, at least periodically? And I ask that question because I grew up in the civil rights movement, which never ended. We are still in a civil rights movement. And I say that because my brothers were part of the Black Panther, Black Power. My sister, who was the secretary that met in the basement in secret of our church. So we had the Martin Luther King in our household. We had the Black Panther in our household, but I would see them collaborate together in the household. So I think it goes back to a house divided. So what do you say about, or is there any rumblings of coming together so that we can educate our children how to behave when a police officer pulls them over? We can educate our people how to learn the system and make the system work for you. You know, those kinds of things.
Let me put it to Mary, because there has been tension between some of the historic organizations and some of the young people stepping forward in the movement. Is there a chance for a meeting of the minds at some point?
I think there does need to be an opportunity to build across movements for several reasons. And I think that one is because there's so many lessons we need to squeeze up out of each other. You know, they say every time an old person dies, a library gets burned down. Like, there's so many stories right. that we need. There's so many people that we don't that we didn't know about, that we need to learn about. We need that. And at the same time, we also need to grapple with the contradictions that were had, like why there had to be a Black feminist movement that needed to happen because some of y'all weren't exercising your power right. How some folks actually got into the system and actually co-signed on mandatory minimums and co-signed on a 1994 crime bill. Like, folks have to be honest about how our access and our privilege and being the first one to do a particular thing has cost many of us who were still left over there and behind, quote unquote. And also saying that the moving from the assimilation movement, if you will, and we'll try to, you know, fit in and all that sort of stuff. People are in a different place. And so I think collectively we have to come together, if for nothing else to vision. I think people, without a shared vision at least, we won't see that in the now, We have to find the ways in which we align. We have to come together at those points of alignment and have some impact around that. And I think, and people are like, what is the shared demand that we can have that we all can move on? Black people, for generations, our demand has always been abolition, abolition, free us, abolition. And in this context, it's looked like mass incarceration. And so those folks who are from previous movements and other generations, that there is a particular role that they should be playing and helping to transfer relationships, again, be able to where they sit in their seat of privilege and power to actually, what are you willing to give up and pour into the movement right now? And also not saying and understanding where their role is, like I was saying. So there is a joint effort and there is some principled struggle that needs to happen. But one thing we're clear about is we need each other. We need each other. And we also aren't going to have false unity based on being unprincipled in the way we do it. Like, let's be honest, so we can move, you know? And we need to be able to grapple with that without feeling like we can't hold those conversations. And go back to public debates. We need to be able to grow people's politic. When we talk about that there is a civil rights movement that's still happening, actually, it's a human rights movement that's happening because Black folks have moved, brought our vision of liberation has become broader. It's gone beyond we want to get jobs inside the system. We're talking about how do we build cooperative models? How do we, like, create autonomous Black communities? How do we feed each other? Pulling on the legacy of the Black Panther Party and fighting against systemic oppression, pulling on the legacy of the civil rights movement. Like, Black Lives Matter is all of that coming to bear, and all of those other movements that are watching this play out. Come on, get on board, support. Like, let's figure out where we have alignment to actually, like, you know, tear some stuff up together. And not being afraid of taking on the targets who are our people in the city of Atlanta. Real talk, everybody who we got problems with now, right now, are Black. And they pull on the legacy of the civil rights movement all day long. And as if that they're making decisions that actually are benefiting working class and poor Black people. And they saying they part of the, you know what I mean? I'm like, that ain't what King would do. Like, I don't think King would close right. down the Pine Street Center. King wouldn't do that. King would have been begging the question as to why people are homeless from the jump. And so that's the tension we have to grapple with. Those contradictions are real, and they do show up in the way in which we can unify around things beyond police shootings. We're talking about doing the work that's gonna make you lose your job, and folks ain't willing to give that up.
We have about 5 minutes left, so we're going to move on. That probably gives us time for one more question.
Hello. Exactly what is my role as a concerned citizen? I think that we do an excellent job of identifying the problem, but I'm very results-oriented. I'm not a protester, and it's not because I'm not concerned, but I haven't seen the benefit in it. But I am ready to put my mind to work and put my money where my mouth is. So I guess my question is, what now? I'm always concerned with where do we go from here?
Yeah, this is a perfect question for us to end on. So let's do what we just did about 15 or 20 minutes ago, which is give you each like 2 minutes to answer that. And I'm going to hold you to it because we will end on time, I promise.
Yeah, I only have like maybe even a minute's worth of stuff to say. But the thing about it is, one of the things that we must understand is we must become politically literate. We must understand, anecdotally, my father used to say, in order to bend the rules, you must first know the rules. And there's a concept within African-American history amongst African folk called the renegade Black intelligentsia. And the job is to go amongst this world, to interact within this world, to gain everything so that when you go back to your communities, you're able to educate the people on the beast. And so the thing in that is understanding the conversation in terms of, you know, what is white supremacy. I often teach it as isms equal prejudice plus the use and the abuse of power. Power dictates policy and policy creates law. We need to be able to truly understand how discrimination manifests itself, whether it be through gender politics, whether it be through racism, whether it be through Bill Clinton's three strikes rule, and then Zell Miller, the governor of Georgia, passes a two strikes rule, and this increases the prison industrial complex or the militarization of the police. You must understand how the beast is morphing.
David.
So I'm gonna quote my father too. My dad said something when I was a little guy, and he said, think globally, act locally. And that always really stuck with me. I think that we oftentimes can get caught up in the romantic notions of protest and work for liberation. So when we're looking at it on television, things like that, which becomes important for us to figure out how it is that we're dieting ourselves against our television. But, you know, those things look sexy to us. It's presented like, oh, well, I want to be like that, and I want to, well, that's important, and everybody has a role to play. But one of the things that I said I gave a talk at Cornell a couple of weeks ago to some students who were there, some black students who were there, and I said, you know, how are you going to wear your radical? And what they said was, well, some of them said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to protest, I'm going to get good grades, I'm going to, you know, bear down and do what I need to do now so that I have more flexibility in being, you know, a different type of radical when I leave. And all those were important and good answers. But some folks said, well, you know, I don't really want to, I'm not interested in being, you know, radical. And I said to them the same way that I'll say to folks here is that, well, by definition, you're radical. You know, you're at Cornell University where 3% of you all are black. So your very existence is a political, radical statement. And so what I would challenge, and I typically challenge people to do because I'm in this space of looking at psychology and looking at identity and personalities in particular, is how is it that you are going to wear your radical? How is it that you're going to hold yourself accountable? I think that it's important to be able to spend your money and things like that. The work requires for you to be there. Where are you such that you are making an impact? Is it on children? Is it on peers? Is it on elders? When we're talking about Black Lives Mattering, we're talking about, and let me be very clear, what I'm talking about when I say Black Lives Matter is I'm not begging white folks to understand my humanity. F that. What I'm interested in, I'm sorry, what I'm interested in is I'm very much interested in us being able to assert that our Black Lives Matter, and how is it that you embody that? So again, how do you wear your radical?
Okay, we got about 2 minutes, all right, let me go 2 minutes left.
Boom, boom, boom. All right, I think one of the things that is important is that you're like, yo, I'm not going on the front line. That's not my jam. That's cool. Don't come out there. There's plenty of things that you could do. You can organize a giving circle with your networking, your peers, and then y'all can have conversations to say, hey, based on how we think change happens in this country, or based on our values and our principles, so it's not a head thing. Come and do, you know what I mean? Come with your heart. What do I believe in? And then put the monies toward that. I think one of the things that we've seen is a lot of people give monies to like service-based organizations, which is necessary, right? And we also have to politicize how we spend our money. To do that, which is challenging because we have to give money to service-based organizations or folks who are like feeding or giving coats or what have you. That is a problem that we have to identify because we know the system in the state is not doing what it's supposed to be doing to help support working class people. So we're having to do that. But when we talk about building power and when we're talking about funding a movement that's actually saying we want to identify the root problems of why this is happening so that none of our people have to go hungry. And if that's what you believe in, invest your time, your resources. Again, organize a giving circle. If you have access to other, you know, other small businesses, Black business owners, churches, there's infrastructure that needs to be had. People are looking for cheap buildings to purchase. People need places to meet up in. People need t-shirts printed. I mean, the need is so great. The harvest is ripe and the workers are few. And so we're at a state right now in terms of our movement and the conditions of our people. We just want people to be consistent and make a dedication and say, this is how I show my blackness and my love for my people. It's how I pay my tithe to movement. I pay my tithe to the legacy of Harriet and Malcolm and everybody else who've come before us. I can't physically get out there, but this is what I can do. I can make 100 calls to turn people out to say, y'all know, you know we can't vote for this opportunity school district because that's gonna be, what is that, the black? Brains app, the school takeover. So there is many things that we can do. Where we are situated and located, you know, use whatever place you find yourself in to organize in your circles and our people. Create, you know what I mean? Like, it's possible. And yeah, be in relationship with those folks who are new and who are upcoming and trying to get, you know, stronger organizations and infrastructure. Like, it's helpful. Black Lives Matter, it's helpful. If you want to donate, blacklivesmatteratl.org. We got a PayPal working on our account. I mean, whatever. We're working it out. But that's what we need right now. Don't everybody have to come to the front line. We need folks who are actually willing to do another level of work. Knock on doors, talk to people, build relationships. Again, giving of resources. Whatever you can do will help.
That is Mary Hooks of the Black Lives Matter movement in Atlanta. We also heard from David Wall Rice, associate professor and chair of psychology at Morehouse College, and Professor Maurice Hobson teaches African American studies at Georgia State University. That conversation was inspired by the new PBS documentary Black America Since MLK and Still I Rise. The multi-part series premieres on GPB November 15th and continues on the 22nd at 8 p.m. If you're in Savannah, GPB will host a special screening of the documentary at the Ralph Mark Gilbert Civil Rights Museum tonight at 6 p.m. Visit the Facebook page for On Second Thought if you want more information. That's our show for today, but let's hear from you. What do you think is the most important civil rights movement of our time? Share your thoughts at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. River running free.